So tonight I want to talk about Dharma, which makes sense. I think we are at a Dharma retreat, and the schedule says that now is the Dharma talk, so I think the theme is on. But actually, very explicitly, I would like to offer a reflection on Dharma, on the word Dharma. What is this? What are we talking about actually? I think in many ways, both the Pali and Sanskrit tradition give us all these really interesting Buddhist words that, so many of them individually can be taken as a practice. They can offer us, in a sense, a whole world of contemplative inquiry, investigation, searching, pondering, dukkha, this idea that we call suffering, tanha, this supposed cause of our suffering, all the different ways of talking about liberation or freedom. What does that really mean? And we use this word dharma almost to encapsulate the whole thing. So in a sense, this talk is about what are we doing, where are we going, and very explicitly, what is this dharma? What is at the end of the path? And ultimately, what we're seeking is this elusive dharma. That is the end of the path, but what I'd like to make clear, hopefully, is that to some extent we're already there. It is both the work of being on the path as much as it is a destination. And the work we do has a lot to do with in noticing or understanding that. It's just, in some sense, connecting in with and understanding the Dharma is just this, like, it's just this very subtle turn of the mind, just a little bit. It's like we're already so close. We're so close. And if there's something innate, if there's something essential and natural about this Dharma, how can it be separate from us? And so that's the crux, because we have the sense of going somewhere. And many of our mechanisms for going somewhere have us running away from the Dharma the whole time. It's like, let's go get the Dharma. And then it's like, whoa, we were already really close. So, Dharma, Dharma, or Dhamma, Dhamma, the Pali. I prefer to use the Pali Dhamma, and of course, we all know Dharma because it's just more widely used. But they're the same word, Dharma and Dhamma. So this is an idea, right? This is an idea. And that's why we're talking about it and exploring it. We use words and language to express and explore ideas as a way of understanding them. So this Dhamma is an idea that points toward the possibility of something magnificent, ultimately, for every one of us. Something magnificent. Something unique and yet, as I alluded to earlier, something very, very natural. So how can it be unique? Special is a funny word, but special, how can it can be special? It's special, it's unique and completely natural. So how could that be true? The Dhamma is also an experience marked by the fullness of this possibility. It's an experience of this magnificence. And the Dhamma is a way of being. It's a way of being in the world. And when I was thinking about this, I saw the word magnificence in my notes, and it felt strange. It felt like it wasn't my word. You know, I came up with it as I was sketching my notes, but I looked back and said, "That's I never used that word. I've never used that word." And I don't really know what it means, and I'm really interested in language and what and how words convey, and I like looking words up, and even words that I think I know and that I've known since a child. And so I left this word here, and was ultimately thinking that I would change it. It was like a placeholder in my notes. I said, "Well, I'm trying to express something, and I'm just going to leave magnificent here for now, and then sometime in between, you know, sometime before the talk tomorrow night at 7:30, tonight at 7:30, I'll change it. I'll come up." And that's often how this works for me. I get a few ideas, and then I sit and I walk, and hopefully I find something that's more clear or expressive of what I was trying to say. And it wasn't happening, and I was sitting in my room, and I thought, well, maybe I'll just look magnificent up in the dictionary. And what I found allowed me to like the word and want to leave it here. Impressively beautiful. Impressively beautiful. Very good or excellent. So this Dharma we're looking for is impressively beautiful. Does that sound like something that you want in your life? Does that sound like something that you want to become, to embody, to show the world? And also my hope is that you don't know exactly what it would be like to embody that. And that's what puts us on this contemplative path. That you're called towards something that evokes in a way that it wakes up something in you that you have and yet have not fully obtained. So in a sense, the Dharma is the path of waking up to who we are, but who we have yet to become at the same time. Friend of mine who a few of you know, Adam knows, a couple of you probably know, talks about the path as living in an artful life, living an artful life. I'll talk a little bit later about creativity. Now there are some very common ways that Dharma is defined, and I think these are going to be known to you for the most part, and I want to go over them and then actually I want to mostly put them aside, okay, and then I think that will make more sense in a few minutes. So one way that that Dharma or Dhamma is defined is as a path, right? So I was joking around a little bit at the beginning, and I said that we're on a Dharma retreat. So we're on a retreat that is in and of itself a path, actually. There's a particular kind of meandering that happens from the time that we show up on night one until that final bell rings on the last day, whether we're doing a 4-day retreat or a 10-day retreat or a 30-day retreat. There's a sort of path-like quality. You notice how you don't really know what's around the next bend. I mean, you have no idea what the afternoon is going to be like when you're sitting at 11 o'clock in the morning. You have no idea what tonight is going to be like, right? You have no idea what's going to happen in the 30 minutes that you sit before bed, right? No idea what tomorrow's going to be like. And then there's this longer path of Dharma that is the longer work of going to the meditation center and reading books and talking to your meditation mentor or teacher and going on another retreat next year or later this year. And there's the whole lifelong path of Dharma. So it conveys a sense of going somewhere, a sense of going somewhere. Another common definition is teaching or teachings. So, also at the beginning, when I was being a little bit more playful, I said that it was appropriate that I was talking about Dharma tonight because the schedule says that there's a Dharma talk. So, the Dharma is the words or the ideas of the Buddha. The teachings are intended to convey. Through many, many, many different angles, perspectives, this Dharma. All that we offer and say is pointing toward this Dharma, so hard to see, so subtle. The Dhamma or Dharma refers to law. The way things work. The way things work. A law is how something works. So not in a legalistic sense, but there's something lawful about if gravity is a law, right? In the sense that if I'm up on this roof up here above us and I walk over to where that wall is and I keep going, once both feet move off of that edge, I'm going to fall and hit the ground. That's a law. It's quite difficult for anything other to happen. And so Dharma refers to a great many and a few essential laws or principles that the tradition argues are objectively true. Should we all stabilize the mind, focus our attention, and watch with steady awareness, there are certain things we will see, certain things we will come to understand. And while we have very unique personalities and life stories, there are things that we will come to agree upon. And those simple things refer to the other kind of Dharma, the teachings. We will come to see that certain teachings are themselves the laws that make sense of suffering and its alleviation. So what we see is that suffering itself is lawful, and so is freedom. And then the fourth definition that I want to share with you is one that's been really important to me in my life in terms of finding a view that has a lot of potential for me. And how I've understood that is that it is a definition that gives me a lot of hope, gives me it really widened the definition of Dharma and allowed me to put my life in that definition and really explore. And and it allows me to make the Dharma really, really big. And it doesn't come in this definition of Dharma doesn't in a classical way come from the Buddhist tradition, but more so from the, I would say, the yoga or Hindu tradition, and that is the idea of Swadharma. Svadharma, Swadharma or Svadharma. And this translates as one's own way or what is right for an individual. Sometimes we hear Swadharma encouraging us to live out our sacred duty. The word duty can get tricky, but it refers to the notion that we each have a very unique purpose in the world. You know the famous quote by the dancer Martha Graham? I can't do it verbatim, but something to the extent that we each have a unique way or a unique voice in the world, and that if we don't live that out, that voice is ultimately lost. It will no longer exist, or it won't exist at all. That's the idea of Swadharma. And no one's way is actually better than the others. There's a the cosmic law behind Swadharma is that by living our essential way, by living our truth, by living according to who we are meant to be, we create individual and social harmony, that the world ultimately works better fundamentally. And there's certain principles, and this talk is not about the principles of Swadharma, but it's a really lovely teaching that gives us so much leverage. It says that to seek our Swadharma, we orient our life in such a way that our actions make us happy. We orient our life in such a way that our actions are sustainable. And you know, you can define that in a lot of different ways, right? But I've always liked the idea of creating a more sustainable world. We orient our lives in such a way that our actions benefit others in community. And we orient our lives in such a way that it moves us toward a more free mind that wakes us up. Ultimately, a moksha in Sanskrit, liberation. Right? I love the importance it places on being happy. Right? And I like to say, and you can look into this yourself, there's good literature out there. You know, I particularly when I teach at the college, I give this to the students as a map, and we draw these wheels, and or I rather I have the wheel drawn and I give it to them as a handout. And I have everyone look at their relation, in this case, you know, undergrads and grad students. So I have them look at their school life, you know, books, reading, tests, school life, academically. And I have them look at their relationship, like, you know, friends, any, you know, if they're in a relationship, intimate partner or partners, family, relationship to money, health, like food, body stuff. And spirituality, I might be missing a category. And they rate themselves in the four areas of Swadharma. And that creates the foundation for a course-long investigation of why their numbers are pretty low. And so we're on this path of Dharma where we're moving toward 10, if you will. Moving toward a very integrated life. In all cases, Dharma means truth. In all of these above examples, the Dharma means truth. And though maybe not explicitly, I hope that indirectly you have a better sense of what truth might be when I get to the end of this material. Stephen Cope writes, Stephen was a classical pianist turned minister, turned therapist, turned yoga teacher, who founded the Institute for Extraordinary Living, and wrote a wonderful book called, I think, The Great Work of Your Life, which is an interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita, where I get some renderings of Swadharma that I really like. Stephen says, yogis believe, you're all yogis, right? Those of us who come on retreat and seek the Dharma are yogis. Yogis believe that our greatest responsibility in life is to this inner possibility, this Dharma. And they believe that every human being's duty is to utterly, fully, and completely embody their own idiosyncratic Dharma. This gets at a core principle that from the beginning allowed me access to the Dharma, which I did see to some extent as a as a religion, in addition to a spiritual path that I could define in my own ways. But to the extent that it was a religion and I had concerns about that, I was very attracted to the idea that my discernment was going to be most important, and that the idea of self-awareness meant that I had access to wisdom that would serve me in a way that no one else wouldn't. This idea is conveyed in certain therapeutic schools, particularly a Rogerian school, who says that, you know, even the mentor, counselor, therapist cannot ever trump the client, student, mentee's capacity to become aware of what's right for them. Right. So I want to, in the spirit of that, say really clearly that you should hold, I don't have a lot of shoulds, but you should hold that to the highest degree you can as true, and you should test that. That ultimately you're gonna know in all cases, in all points of discernment, and whatever is important to you, that ultimately you are gonna know what's right for you. You can and only you know your Dharma. Now you're also on the hook to figure it out, and that's the crux, is that we actually are the only ones that can free ourselves at the same time. So the closer we get to this Dharma, the closer we are to freedom, right? To liberation. And freedom also has multiple meanings, and freedom manifests in our lives in very, very different ways. So how do we recognize Dharma? How do we recognize freedom? And what I'll do here for most of the time remaining is I'll talk about some different ways that we can look for this in our own life. So how can we recognize Dharma? Well, the standard, if you will, the textbook response is wisdom and compassion, right? You know that. You know, you go take a 6-week introduction to Buddhism class, and someone stands up in front of the room and they say, this 6-week class is about Dharma. And somebody says, What happens if you have Dharma? And the teacher says, well, you're wise and compassionate. And everybody says, okay, and they write it in their notes, and they go home and they tell their friends, right? But this talk is about what all these words really mean, right? So what is that? What is that? Do you think about it? Does your practice work like that? Do you really like, you know, both intellectually and experientially, do you really find yourself wondering, like, what does this mean? What does this mean? You know, am I doing it? You know, and often we think we are, and then you know, you get really honest, because the Dharma is really about being honest, and you realize, actually, I was just a jackass. You know, actually, I wasn't kind at all. You know, and that's okay, and that's where kindness and equanimity come in. But then you catch yourself. You say, wow, I was really that was very skillful that I did, right? Because you're inquiring, you know, you're wondering, am I wise? Am I wise? Am I being compassionate? This is a very reflective path. It's a very contemplative approach to life. It's a very reflective. It's a very inward. So wise and compassionate doesn't really work. It's okay. But it's almost in a sense it's too canned, or it's my pushback is that it's too obvious, and maybe we don't know what we're saying. Before we have a taste of this Dharma, we tend to put a very limited range of actions under the category of wisdom and compassion. If we ask someone on the street, what is wisdom and compassion? We kind of get a Hallmark greeting card type of answer. Compassion is all too easily associated with being nice. This is we could call this a near enemy. When being nice is often a rule-bound compliance to social norms, and worse, I think, an inability to stand for something more radical when it's needed. But we were nice, right? That's actually the problem. Nice wants to keep things very emotionally tidy. Nice wants to keep things emotionally tidy. Nice is afraid of rustling another person's feathers. And nice is afraid of being abandoned by someone who is important to us. One of the tricky things about being authentic, one of the tricky things about advocating for wisdom in the world and trying to develop right speech, is that we tend to go too far, and we cause some harm unintentionally, and then we have to get good at backing up and seeing our place in it, hopefully apologizing and being curious, why did it happen, and can I not do it again? And we can do that dance with some people in our lives, and with other people we can't. We can do it more easily with those who are seeking the Dharma. And I think that's one of the reasons that we discover we like Sangha so much. Because if we can be unskillful in our pursuit of going where we're going, and not be abandoned, and if we can be in the company of others who are not always the way we want them and not abandon them, now we're starting to get a taste of what care and love is like. Right? And now we have family. It's just a really big one. This weekend it's got like 17 people, right? So that's part of what we're doing. And in this country, we have a big family of thousands of against the streamers trying to develop this kind of care and love that arises out of our seeking and searching for the Dharma. And then wisdom is often reduced to a kind of predictable intelligence or some kind of behavior that has become prescriptively spiritual. You know, maybe being quiet or saying om at the end of a yoga class, or I don't know, you know, but we just have to be, we have to be careful. Wisdom, I think, even more than compassion, really shakes people up. Wisdom can be, wisdom has so much, it has so much creativity in it that it can catch us off guard, and it's often so outside the norm. I mean, we all know that normative structures for getting things done with the excellence of the Dharma doesn't, our society doesn't operate that way. And so sometimes when wisdom comes in, it really shakes us up. You know, it can be very cutting. So I want to try to talk about some expressions of Dharma, some ways that are, I'm going to argue, very ordinary. Wisdom and compassion seem so grandiose, don't they? Sound good. We want it. We want it from others, and we want to cultivate it so that we can share it with them. But it's so obtuse. It's so ambiguous. And can we? So the question I'm holding is: Can we give it some? Can we give it some traction? Can we talk about it in a way that helps us touch it in our own lives? So, this is a list of how we can see signs of Dharma in our own lives and in the lives of others. And the first one of these on my list is resilience. When we start to get a taste of the Dharma, we become more resilient. In a sense, we can move on. In really, really ordinary language, we can move on. Right? What allows us to move on? Seeing impermanence, in Pali, anicca. We know that dukkha or suffering is real. We know that change is real. So when we stop resisting these fundamental laws, we're free to move on. Right? We don't have to stay back here trying to micromanage, which is to say often keep from changing something that inevitably must change. So we let that job, we let that relationship, we let that new shiny thing break up, we let things change. The car gets rusty, the amazing job gets boring, the person who was the most amazing partner in the world is actually not able to be kind to us hardly ever, right? So we have to move on. Someone we've spent a very long time with dies, right? And we have to move on, right? So resilience is not repressive and it's not dismissive, and it doesn't mean we're not in pain, and it doesn't mean we're not grieving, and it doesn't mean that we're not lonely, but it does mean we move on, which means we don't cling, which means we don't suffer. And sometimes you'll be able to do this with ease, and sometimes you won't. And so notice when it's not easy, what's going on here? What's going on here? What is the view that I hold that doesn't allow me to integrate one of the most fundamental laws of the Dharma, that things change? How else can we recognize this Dharma? This is a little harder to talk about, I think. There's a way in which the Dharma starts to manifest. I'm going to say that people are kind of inside themselves. I'll have to try to unpack this. People are kind of inside themselves. There's a sense of containment. They're not leaky. Do you have some leaky people in your life, or maybe at the grocery store? Do people spill all kinds of stuff on you or something? Like, there's a sense of being inside, and I'm going to contrast this in a minute. There's a sense of being inside themselves, or contained, or attuned, inwardly attuned. There's a sense of, I think this person is really tracking themselves. There's and it's not like we just get there and we radiate this all the time, but have you ever been with someone and you walk away and you think, oh, that's what presence is. That person weighs 125 pounds, and standing next to them, it felt a little more like 500. Like, that person's feet were on the ground. Like, that person is inside themselves. Their awareness is in their body. That person is connected to something. It's hard to talk about. What I'm getting at is hard to talk about. Now, at the same time, and this category is all about the duality, at the same time, this person is simultaneously very aware of their surroundings. They're inside themselves, but they're very available. They're very available. Can you get a sense of that? Contained inside oneselves and connected and open and available. Right? This person has the capacity for presence and exchange. The exchange doesn't require words. This is a way of talking about, fundamentally, of talking about awareness. I'm trying to find a way of talking about awareness, presence and awareness. So there's some sense of mindfulness of inner and outer. Mindfulness of inner and outer. The Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutra on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, talks about this, mindfulness of inner and outer. Number three, this Dhamma is decisive. This Dhamma is decisive. The mind doesn't waver. The mind, that ambiguity we all get caught in sometimes. It can be there's the big ambiguities that are really it's really easy for us all to have a lot of empathy for, like, should I quit my job or should I stay? Sometimes you're standing in lunch and your bread is in the toaster and you're thinking peanut butter or jelly. No, maybe both. No, just butter. But and salt. I'll put butter and salt. Butter and salt. No, but if I put the peanut butter on, that'll be more protein. That's good. I'll do the peanut butter. And then you're walking away and you get the bread with the peanut butter and you're like, shit, I should have done the jelly. Right? The mind is wavering. Doubt can show up on so many levels. So, to say that we're able to be decisive, we're saying that the mind is able to commit. Right? You don't need to run by the board of directors whether it should be peanut butter or jelly. Right? It's like the mind knows that either option is okay. Right? It'll be okay. It'll be okay. So one has begun to doubt. That doubt is a real indication of a lack of capacity. One has begun to doubt that one's own experience of doubt is a real indication of a lack of capacity. So you begin to doubt doubt. What is doubt? I don't have capacity. I don't trust myself, or I don't trust another person. But what happens if you doubt doubt? That person can take risks. So resilience leads to risk-taking in the best sense of that word. So what happens if we're able to take risks? Or how do we take risks? Well, here's the thing. Risks are facilitated not because one always gets what they doesn't. Risks are facilitated not because one always gets the outcome they want, but for two other primary reasons. One, they are starting to trust that they can emotionally tolerate not getting what they want. You see how different this is than doing something because you know the outcome will match your, what you want it to be? Because if we're waiting to know that the outcome will be what we want, how often are we going to move toward that job, person, hobby, life goal? Pretty slim. The people who you watch and admire, who are doing all sorts of things, taking risks, they don't know that it's going to work out. Little secret. They do not know. Number two, they understand that getting what they want is part a matter of percentages. What does this mean? If you never take risks, you never get what you want. Or mostly don't. Maybe someone gives you what you want sometimes, right? If you never take risks, you never get what you want. If you sometimes take risks, you sometimes get what you want. In other words, you need to be willing to fail in order to succeed. The point is, sometimes you succeed. So can the sense of self hold the failure? Well, if the self is a fleeting, impermanent, flawed theory to begin with, no problem. I'm just a human being trying my best, and sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. In this path of Dharma, we're asked to check in on the level of intention. Is there some sort of ethical conduct or motive behind my actions? Put that in place. And if yes, go for it. Right? If the heart and mind are inclined toward the betterment of self and other, that action is, we could say, pure. And we can rest our faith in risk taking on that and see what happens. Okay, moving on to the next one. When we're in touch with this Dhamma, our actions represent what is needed. Our actions represent what is needed. Which is to say that our actions in body, speech, and mind are responsive to the causes and conditions of each situation. And this implies creativity. Our actions and body, speech, and mind are responsive to the causes and conditions of each situation. Okay. What is creativity? Well, unexpected or unusual strategies are employed to get something done. That's creativity. If you work with an art teacher for 8 months and they always draw a mountain peak and put a little tree on the top, are you always going to put a little tree on the top? Right? It's like, what is required? This is possible when the mind is not limited to only what it knows from past experience. While, however, the mind can adapt or appropriate what might be relevant from past experience. So there's nothing carbon copy about this Dharma. The Dharma is always fresh. The Dharma is always fresh. You know? One of the classic archetypes of this is, you know, like, and it's more classical of Zen style training than other lineages, but you know, it's like student goes into meditation interview, which is Dokusan in the Zen tradition, and I'm just gonna have to make this up on the fly, but let's just say the student says, "When I meditate, my left shoulder hurts a lot," and the teacher says, "Sit straighter," rings the bell, student leaves. Next student goes in, student says, "When I meditate, left shoulder hurts." Teacher says, "Every half an hour, go for a long walk." You know. So there's a sense of being able to see nuance. Who's asking the question? Why are they asking the question? What's really being asked? You know, we get it all the time. You know, I left the retreat and so-and-so said that they were sleepy all the time. And I was sleepy and you gave me this answer. And then they, you know, you gave me totally an answer. It's like, well, it's different. You're not them. You know? You know? Two different people. Right? Remember? Dharma. It's very individualistic. Likewise, Likewise, actions are proportionate to the situation. So this refers to understanding the degree of problem. Accurately gauging the level of severity or the level of truth. So one's response to a situation is proportionate to the real threat rather than the perceived threat. Does that make sense? One's response to a situation is proportionate to the real threat rather than the perceived threat. You know, so you're sitting, you're like the 10th person in line for food. And you can look and you can see that the good stuff's almost gone. Like with all the cheese on top and, you know, and there's like one little corner over there that's got like, you know, most of the cheese, and for sure one of the 10 people in front of you is gonna get that corner of the tray. And, you know, the grasping, the craving energy is so strong, you're like, you're up against the person in front of you in line, you know, and they're like, precepts, you know. And some part of you is a little bit nervous. Craving is craving. You know, whether it's to have more money or have more cheese or be free of a difficult relationship, or, you know, craving is very painful. And what is your nervous system doing in the lunch line? What is your nervous system doing on the way to work, in the car, when you're going to have a meeting with someone who you don't, you know, you just have a difficult relationship with? You know, raise your hand if at any moment, let's see, today, in the last three meals we've had, did you bump up against any even small amount of dukkha somewhere in the kitchen? For any reason, too many people or, yeah, right? And the amount of time it takes all of us to stand in line and get our food, someone in any number of different medium-sized city in the Middle East has wired a car bomb successfully, and by the time you finish your meal, two parents in a backseat of children have died. And you'll never know about it, because it happens so many times every day, it doesn't make the news. So how else does the Dharma present itself? One is open. We use this word a lot. Open in this case means that self-protection is low enough to allow for vulnerability. So, you know, basically vulnerability is not seen as a weakness, but it's an achievement. How much time do we spend trying to be smart or clever, or how much time do we spend trying to not have any problems? I'm good. I'm great today. Thank you for asking. You know. So we can allow what is hard in life to touch us, and we don't need to push it away. That's all. We can allow what's hard in life to touch us. Why is this Dharma? Well, the first noble truth is that life is hard. That's it. Right? And what happens when you don't push it away? It's not that hard. Because it's the acceptance that creates space around experience which makes it tolerable. It's the pushing it away that makes it solid. Because the sense of self is fixated on something perceived as other. And that situation needs to be resolved for you to be okay. But that is samsara. And when you hold it and observe it and feel it, now you've put it in the spaciousness of acceptance. And now you're starting to lean into the third noble truth, which is cessation. Now you're more free. External conditions haven't changed. This is the Dharma. This is liberation. So how else can we recognize this dharma? Curiosity. One who has started to touch this dharma is curious to a level high enough that life has become very interesting. Even in regard to the mundane, if not particularly at the level of what some might call mundane. This is starting to occur parallel to one's ability to see the dharma, parallel to one's ability to see that dharma expressed as the truth of how things work is very subtle. This curiosity, therefore, is also connected to the wisdom that one does not have all the answers, but one is seeking to know. So this requires an immense curiosity. And this fuels the contemplative nature of the path, which we often talk about as investigation. And the last, there are more, but the last of this list is equanimity, or being equanimous. So how is this a manifestation of the Dharma? There's less of a need for things to be different. That's how it plays out, right? You know this. Sometimes you find yourself with this magnificent capacity, and it usually catches us off guard. We're in a situation that would otherwise be difficult, and we realize that our practice is really coming through, and we're okay. You know, it's like, whoa. You know, and you look down and you're like, yeah, it's still me. Like, it must be someone else that's okay. Like, no, I'm totally fine. Right? So there's a real wisdom component. Equanimity is the result of wisdom. Okay. We can see this in two ways. Even if one might want things to be different, it is understood that change is dependent upon conditions, and not all of those conditions are under our control. That's wisdom. That's seeing clearly. Even if one might want things to be different, it is understood that change is dependent upon conditions, and not all of those conditions are under our control. And we know that. And two, for one who has touched the Dharma, or who is in touch with the Dharma at any given moment, their primary allegiance is to freedom over having their immediate needs met. And they understand that freedom requires the elimination of aversion and grasping. It mandates that we get good at being with. Being with. Everything we do from 6:30 in the morning until 10 o'clock at night, or later, if you have the energy and you're still practicing, is fundamentally a training in being with, which is to counter the ingrained, conditioned mechanism of tanha, which is the second noble truth of craving. This is why I've been using language like re-inhabiting the present moment. Right? Put yourself, what did I say earlier? Put yourself in the present moment. Put yourself in the present moment. Put yourself in your back pain. Put yourself in your restlessness. Put yourself in your self-doubt. Put yourself in your mixed feelings. Put yourself in your boredom. Go inside and find the Dharma there. And if you look clearly, closely, you'll notice you're mostly looking for it somewhere else. You're reviewing the past, looking for the Dharma, or you're playing out some possibility in your future, looking for the Dharma in your suffering. That's samsara. That's samsara. And then lastly, regarding Dharma as one's own way, referring to Swadharma, this more Hindu or yogic notion of the word, one shows signs of living their purpose. One shows signs of living their purpose. Expressing themselves in relationship, work, hobby, in a way that is meaningful to them. It does not mean that someone is at the pinnacle of their quest, but rather simply that they are on that path. So if you are confused about that path, cumulatively, or at any one of these areas, relationship, work, hobby, does it mean you're not practicing Swadharma? You're not in touch with this path? No. But can you enter into the longing? Can you enter into the confusion? Can you face this life stage? Can you face this dilemma, this time of discernment, openly? Can you stay there? Can you stay with yourself? Can you do what's needed, right? From Stephen Cope, who I mentioned earlier. What do you fear most in this life? What is your biggest fear right now? When I pose that question to myself, the answer is this: I'm afraid that I'll die without having lived fully. Okay, I'm also afraid of pain and of dying a difficult death, but that's for later. Mostly right now, I'm afraid that I may be missing some magnificent possibility, that perhaps I have not risked enough to find it, that maybe I've lived too safe a life. Thomas Merton says, what you fear is an indication of what you seek.
What does that mean?
Most of the rest of this passage is an attempt to define that. Thomas Merton says, for now, I'll read it again. Thomas Merton says, what you fear is an indication of what you seek. Every now and then, in my quest for answers, I stumble across a sentence that stands up and shouts at me from the page. Here is a sentence I read recently in the pages of the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas. If you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. I have to admit that the second phrase of the sentence hit me the hardest. It will destroy me? In retrospect, I realize that I felt the punch of that second phrase only because I had genuinely experienced moments of the first. I do know the experience of bringing forth what is within me. For most of my life, these bringing forth moments have been fleeting. But twice, I've had the experience sustained over a period of years. I have friends who are right now bringing forth what is within them. Anyone can see it in their faces. These are people who leap out of bed in the morning. They are digging down, connecting with their connecting with their own particular genius and bringing it into the world. They are bringing forth their point of view, their idiosyncratic wisdom. They are living out their vocations. And let me tell you, they are lit up. This way of lit up living can happen in any sphere. Not a single one of my lit up friends is writing a book, by the way. One of my friends, Mark, that's a reference to the fact that he had explained earlier in a passage I didn't read that during those years when he felt it connected with his Dharma, he was writing a book. One of my friends, Mark, is busy building a new institution, an alternative prep school. My friend Sandy is mastering the art of nursing hospice patients. Can you imagine leaping out of the bed in the morning to confront the dying? She does, and actually, I can imagine it. One of my friends is busy mastering Beethoven's string quartets. Day and night she practices. My friend David is on fire, creating an entirely new genre of landscape painting. Alan is mastering the art of gardening and just, really, the art of living life as a naturalist. My sister Arlie is mastering the, to me, incomprehensible task of parenting an adolescent, but with such relish, you cannot believe it. Have you had periods in your life when you leapt out of bed in the morning to embrace your day? Once this happens to you, once you live this way, even for a few hours, you will never really be satisfied with any other way of living. Everything else will seem vaguely wan and gray. Everything else will seem, as Henry David Thoreau said, like a distraction. Maybe you're saying to yourself, it's not that black and white. You can't live this way all the time. Maybe this guy, referring to himself, the author, is just in a dry period. Something like what the Christian saints call a desert experience. Maybe these dry periods are just as productive, really, and every bit as necessary as the wet periods. Maybe you can't even dream of bringing forth what is within you without a requisite amount of aridity. This is a good point. Besides, it is impossible to tell from the outside who is and who is not bringing forth what is within them. And, in truth, leaping out of bed in the morning really has very little to do with it. It's good news for people who like to sleep in. But still, there is a vast difference between the desert experience of the saints and watching endless reruns on TV, isn't there? But for now, here's an experiment. Stop reading for a minute, and ask yourself these questions. Am I living fully right now? Am I bringing forth everything I can bring forth? Am I digging down into that ineffable inner treasure house that I know is in there, that trove of genius? Am I living my life's calling? Am I willing to go to any lengths to offer my genius to the world? Okay, so let's sit together for just a moment.